We are now going to begin looking into Revelation chapter 18. It's got a total of 24 verses. So Revelation 18 through the first little bit of chapter 19 is a single unit. We're going to, I think, divide this into about three parts. We're going to look at the first eight verses of chapter 18 this morning. This is the fall of Babylon. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she herself has paid back others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. As she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, 'I sit as a queen, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see.' For this reason her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine. And she will be burned up with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who has judged her." So some reminders, Revelation is a symbolic drama. There's hyperbole, in other words, exaggeration, and fantastic images. We should not assume literalness of anything that we see. Revelation borrows language and images from the Old Testament. So would it, Jesus and the church are new depictions of Old Testament prophecies. John borrows those languages and uses them to describe Jesus and the church. A reminder that this is not allegory. If you remember, the difference between allegory and symbolism or metaphor is that in an allegory, the author intends elements to have a specific corresponding literal counterpart.
One-to-one symbolism.
In a symbolic or metaphorical literature, it's more just kind of the overall sense that something is like, something that is being talked about is like something that is happening in the real world. So what John is using is he's using languages and images to connect the new depictions back to old ideas. So he's not saying necessarily that every or perhaps any details are going to take place exactly as they are written. Revelation, we've seen, it's depicting a conflict between two systems of government, two systems of principles. It's not primarily about physical individual Christians against physical oppressors. There's been reminders throughout that Revelation is speaking about the church as an entity and the oppressors of the church as another entity, and that not necessarily individual people. It is about God's and Jesus' principles of restorative justice versus Satan's principles of punitive justice. Restorative justice is destroying the works of the devil and sin so that humans can be freed from fear, particularly of death, in order to serve God willingly and freely. Punitive justice is all about giving what each person deserves. and as a note, which is subtly but vastly different from getting what is deserved. Giving what is deserved is different from getting what is deserved. In giving, there is a causative agent that hands down punishment or rewards. In getting what is deserved, there does not have to be a causative agent. It can simply be a consequence, the logical end result of following through.
And that's called punitive?
Punitive is giving what each person deserves.
And that's what
it's whether it's punishment or rewards. And that's punitive justice. That is the system of justice that all secular powers use.
Like the police.
Yeah, all governments are based on punitive justice. And so, service is based upon either expectation or fear of what might come.
Because secular governments cannot depend on each person naturally getting what they deserve. So they have to mete out judgment, either positive or negative, in an artificial way.
Right. The system of rewards and punishment is the basis of punitive justice. Mm-hmm. It's the way secular powers keep their subjects in line. Mm-hmm. There is no room for love in punitive justice. Revelation, so it's about a conflict between these two systems of government. It's about the worship of each respective system and the inevitable results of each type of worship. So every entity, every person, ends up worshiping one type of justice or another.
You're differentiating between getting and giving.
Mm-hmm.
Where does getting fall under?
Getting falls under the getting is not part of punitive justice.
Right.
You know, if you smoke, you're going to shorten your life. That's.
But is it a result of refusing?
Yeah, I see.
Restorative justice. If you refuse restorative justice, you're going to be under getting justice.
Right. A person can refuse to be freed.
God's justice is everyone will get in the end what they choose, basically. They will either get freedom, eternal life, etc., or else death, separation from God. Just like if you smoke, you will get lung cancer, fairly likely. But a secular system can't impose, a secular system feels the need to impose that on people, where God's system simply says that this will be the result. If you do this, this will happen. If you follow God and be kind to your neighbor, you will have love, mercy, grace, and eternal life.
basically, it comes back to faith. Do you really believe God when he says you will get what you deserve? Do we really believe that? And if we don't believe it, then we go out there and try to impose by giving what they deserve.
Well, by giving everybody what they deserve, yeah. What we think they deserve. And God says, if you choose to trust only yourself and do what you, if you don't trust God, if you are selfish and unkind to your neighbor, you will receive unpleasantness in the end. It's a simple fact.
Well, it seems you've typed it out pretty clearly here. But I don't think it's in the general public. Is that differentiation recognized?
In child rearing, there is a differentiation between traditional punishment and natural consequences, and it is considered. I remember when my kids were little, it was considered preferable to allow natural consequences to take effect. Letting the child punish himself for his own misdeeds.
Where were you doing that at? Because my mom would do that. I thought it was cruel.
Well, I don't know.
Because, like, in our system, where when I was younger, and remember instances where somebody had a problem with the way my mom dealt justice. Was in instances where, like, the neighbors saw me building a ramp for my bike that was obviously dangerous. Uh-huh. And my mom standing there watching the whole thing. And the neighbor saying, are you going to let your son do that? And she said, absolutely. And they said, well, how can you let him get hurt? And she said, because then I don't have to sit here and be the bad guy explaining to him why he hurt himself. And I jumped off the ramp broke, I fell and came running to her, and she pointed to the bathroom where the band-aids were. And all sorts of instances like that in my life where, you know,
and where
being a boy hurt, and it was my fault.
And if you broke your toy was broken, she's not going to go out and get you another toy. You broke your toy.
More so it was that she was willing to let... It perturbed more mothers and more people around her more that she didn't do anything to intervene
to
constantly to have their form of justice be told. Mm-hmm. Instead of my mother running out and saying, no, you shouldn't build this ramp, it's for your own safety, it was hard for them to even comprehend the idea that she wasn't saving her child all the time from everything that was happening around it and giving it its for her form of reasoning versus letting things say
and when
happen
kids
the way
get
they
older,
should.
If a parent does something that's illegal and goes to jail, the parent can choose between bailing him out and fixing it all for him, or saying, well, hey, that you chose it, you deal with it, you pay the jail
price.
You're gonna sit there for a while. That's simply the way it works. That's what you chose. And I think that's what God is doing. He's saying, you chose it. That's what happens.
Well, I have a really great base for that ideology, because I used to basically consider my mom like a crocodile. she shoved me in her mouth and spit me out into the river and left me on my own from that point on. Because that's kind of how I viewed her parenting until I was about 23. Started to realize, well, okay, maybe in a morbid sense, she did actually give me a better chance to understand my own ability, mm-hmm. rather than imposing me to her.
Imposing her way of thinking on what you should be doing and what you should.
Yeah, but it's a fine line because you could.
It's
you know, nowadays you're dealing with some children in some ways of the secular world, I guess, that don't believe in telling anybody any consequences whatsoever.
No.
And then you have video game raised, lazy, mean people that don't have any idea of what it's like to actually interact
with
people.
You've got parents who never tell the kid no and let them do whatever they want no matter what. And yeah, that's also. But letting a kid learn on their own what's good and what's bad, and letting a kid face the consequences, that can certainly be.
Well, it's a tough...
You still have to... Each parent still has to choose what they're willing to let their kid face.
What, taking this back to Mount Carmel...
We're still in the...
If Ray built a ramp and used it and broke his leg, Ray probably understood that the broken leg was a consequence of his ramp.
Mm-hmm. That was a situation where the consequences were clear and immediate.
But what's happened is, by learning that, Ray learned that consequences were the result of choices.
Mm-hmm.
If his mother had prevented him from building the ramp, he would not have learned that consequences were the result of choices, but would have learned that consequences were the giving someone else dealt out. And that's what happened at Mount Carmel. People didn't see that, I'll just use an absurd one, smoking. The consequence of smoking is cancer. If Ray had learned from his ramp, the consequence of building a ramp is a broken leg, then Ray probably also learned that the consequence of smoking is cancer. If, on the other hand, if the justice was met out, then they don't look at the cancer as a consequence, they look at the cancer as a punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was happening on Mount Carmel. And that's what we do in our world. We think that the punishment for sin is death. We need to learn that
the consequence of sin is death. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but you got to remember that the evolution of the human heart doesn't necessarily learn its lesson with just the ram. It took a lot more than that to come to the ideology that my actions directly resulted in the consequences that are what I'm dealing with.
But if your mother had let you build the ramp and then caught you when you were about to fall off it.
Majority of people feel like the punishment of sin rather than the consequences of sin.
That makes sense.
Well, that's why we have
in our culture
movements in our society right now that are absolute in their ideology that everything that's happening to us is happening to us because we are being punished, not mm-hmm. because and everything we do is and our faith based is a fear based program that keeps you from doing what you know you're capable of doing. Now the beauty of the ramp analogy is that not only did my mom let me do the stupid things that I was going to do that got me in trouble, she also let me do what looked to be stupid that ended up resulting in being some of the best life-changing things that I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
And only at the time that she started to pull the reins back on things that I was doing did she ever really start to realize the things that she wasn't letting me do. And the one time she did that, she came to my job on the fishing boat and decided that I and the captain were wrong for not contacting her for the 40-some-odd days that I'd been absent on a boat without telling her that I was there. And the one time where I'd actually seen somebody shut my mom up for her righteousness was when the captain said to my mother that the boat gets in every day at 8 o'clock and leaves every day at 10 o'clock. And within any of those days that you were worried about your son, you could have come down here and done exactly what you're doing right now, 41 days ago. So that was her opportunity to have that same thing asked of her. And so that opened up a door for me to be able to do something amazing, which most parents probably wouldn't let their, 12-year-old child go out on a boat with a bunch of men by themselves for that long. And so those are things that I think God gives us when we separate that line of somebody needing to come in and take control and tell us how to do it and keep us safe is a lot of times keeping us from seeing the potential of our person. It's a great way to keep people from doing what they can do.
Are you saying that God does not mete out justice for sin? Does God does not mete out punishment for sin? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's a huge statement.
I guess there many would argue from the Old Testament that, well, didn't God punish? Well, that was the Old Testament writers' perceptions of what was happening.
People perceived God as having punished, but...
What you're saying is huge. And that's... I appreciate what you're saying about Mount Carmel. I think that's the crux of it.
So Revelation then is about these conflict between two ways of living, two ways of governing. And it's about the temptation that the church faces, God's people, God's servants face, to buy into the world system of justice and worshiping it. Because for the church, the temptation is for immediate gratification, as it is for any individual person. Immediate gratification. Now, reducing oppression. Who enjoys being oppressed by other people, other groups, by governments?
Not so much.
Not so much. By simply buying into the world's way, the church could reduce that immediately. They can gain respectability. Conform to the forms of emperor worship, the imperial cult, and you gain respectability. You can gain influence. All of a sudden, you're no longer an outcast, you're part of the group. You might be able to improve your finances, you might gain more members. The world's way offers stability and security. At least that's what the world claims. The people, the groups holding power claim, well, I can offer you stability, I can offer you security if you will buy into our ways.
And that's the hardest thing to deal with, though, is because it's such a gray area all the time where you're sitting there asking yourself or your individual groups and what and how you're supposed to walk that fine line of the world and worship. And it's constant, no matter who you are, trying to justify what you can and can't do in the world, or what you should and shouldn't be doing.
Especially when the rules aren't constant. I mean, in the New Testament, Paul says, yes, it's okay to eat food sacrificed to idols. And John says, no, it's not okay. And they're in two different situations.
But the food part is like only the beginning. It's even worse. Like, what do you do with everything that happens, you know, against you in your life? Like, you feel, like Mark is saying, you can gain security, you can gain financial wealth, you could have all of these things if you have the ways of the world. But how do you know
what you're not
supposed to be doing in the world? Besides those things, how do you know that you're even living outside of the world when you're trying to not do those things even?
How do you know what is right when the rules aren't constant? When there's no constant set of rules that says this is okay and this is not okay all the time, no matter what.
Well, no, it's not even that. It's the fact that, like, there's only one rule. And the one rule kind of portrays itself like you're not supposed to do anything. Like, somebody throws a rock at you, you're not even supposed to be mad about it. And then somehow you're supposed to let that person throw another rock at you, or find another place to go immediately so that people don't throw rocks at you.
Yeah.
And that's a scary proposition.
The reminder again is, this is talking about the church as a whole. The church as a whole is not to embrace the ways of the world.
I have a question on that plane. Is it appropriate for civil authority to have civil punishments in order to have
civilization?
I mean, we have speeding tickets. I mean, speed limits. We have speeding tickets. Mm-hmm. We have rules of operation. We have setbacks and houses have to be set back from the street so far for fire regulations or whatever.
I don't think Revelation is addressing that.
So it's okay within a civil authority to have punitive justice?
Yeah.
Okay. The problem is, punitive justice does work in making a government so that you have civilization rather than anarchy.
The world is not composed only of people who are devoted to God.
Right.
It's a mixture of all sorts of people. And so the rules that govern, that God's rules only work if the entirety of the population is submitted to God's rule.
That's right. And so we see that this punitive justice works in the civil environment, and it is. And what you're advising here is we need to be careful if we adopt that into the religious environment. The question is, in their thinking, the civil and the religious were the same. There was no different government. In ours there is, but not back then.
True.
So it kind of goes back to quite a while ago, might even have been last winter, when we were talking about judgment and what the responsibility of judgment was in the church, and how as a church we were not to condemn or to use condemnation as a form of teaching or telling or hurting somebody, but to use a judgment which was meant to only build that person's influence toward Christ and toward the church. So instead of doing the whole like constructive criticism type mentality toward somebody, you were supposed to only give your best effort to help that person become closer to the church and closer to God, rather than saying, oh, well, you just screwed up, but it's going to be okay, because if you do things the way we tell you to do them now, you're going to be just fine. I can't really...
I don't know. I think constructive criticism can still be appropriate. But I think it needs to be done in an encouraging manner, in a manner that's focused on helping people become who they
It comes down to each situation is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Every person or group that you're engaging with is going to be different. Take a look at Jesus' interactions with the different groups, and he, some of his ways of interacting comes across as quite harsh.
He was also very gentle with people that society as a whole saw as totally unacceptable.
I'm wondering, is in a perfect world, as you said, the restorative justice works, but in an imperfect world, we have to recognize there has to be a civil and a church has to, and in the Judaist whatever way, they had combined the civil and the religious, and Jesus basically in his life separated the civil from the religious, and so he would say, render unto Caesar's what's to Caesar's, but then he would work over here in the religious sphere. So maybe what he's saying is, in a real world, sinful world that we live in, you have to have two separate.
Yeah, there are two kingdoms. In the present time, there are two kingdoms.
There has to be. Where Jews didn't want that. They wanted to combine it, and by so doing, they got themselves in trouble.
Well, God, the restorative way is God's way of dealing with his people, with us, with the church, with individuals in the church. But people's way of dealing with each other, if we simply deal with each other in a spiritual way, then we can stay with that. But when we're dealing with civil authority, then we can't depend on that as being...
So Pastor Mark could be a policeman, he could wear a gun, and he could execute justice in a punitive fashion and still be operating in a restorative viewpoint, interacting with his community. There
it
is two different kingdoms.
Difficult. It might be difficult for a person to consolidate that in their mind. It certainly could happen.
Does this basically go along with the lines that John was saying not to pray for those? Because he was saying, don't pray for those that aren't repenting. Because it kind of seems like, okay, so if the church as a whole is trying to commune with each other and to keep their faith separate from the punitive world, from delving out the justice that we see served, are we saying then to only minister to those that are actually looking for Christ rather than trying to go out and change the imperfect world into Christ's likeness, into what we want them to be? So
I think Revelation is quite clear, at least from John's perspective, that the systems, the governments, the etc., what is of the world will never change, no matter how much Christians go about trying to change it.
So it's very evident that John is speaking to those that are already listening.
And
yes.
If we try to impose God's will,
John is writing to Christians.
He is writing to those that are already listening. And
underneath
the
Roman government.
And the fact that we would try to evangelize the rest of the world into what we want them to be is...
Well, there is nothing wrong with sharing the gospel.
Right.
But there is everything wrong with trying to change the systems of the world.
Right.
Well, but trying to impose God's way on...
any sort of imposition is against God's way.
So is there some validity to the forefathers asking so when the forefathers were saying a separation of church and state, they were simply asking that as Americans, we devote God and God's house and we use the rest of the place to do what we're doing. We don't ask, we don't use the church to persuade the rest of the people to do what we want them to do. We use our government as a separate entity of our faith in the Lord, rather than using the Lord to sway the entire country to do what
right.
we expect them to do.
I believe that there is a huge wall of separation between church and state powers. The church should not try to influence state powers. Now, individual Christians can use the rights that are granted to them to make the best decisions that they believe the government should be making.
Right.
But the church
that I believe are best.
Should not be doing, or any church or parachurch or any religious entity should not be using their influence.
So they shouldn't be devoting their time to political people trying to help those people get into office. They should not be trying to influence the political scene in any
not
way, shape, or form
as church.
A church. Uh-huh.
As individuals, you have the right. As a citizen, but not as a member of a church.
As a citizen, we have the responsibility to influence government to improve.
But even in the sense of a politician using faith to sway people,
it goes the other way as well.
Because that, to me,
government,
is the most blasphemous thing that coming out of political venue is they will use a faith-based...
Right. Politics should not appeal to faith.
Exactly.
As in, government should change and be this way because my religion says so.
Exactly. I get very offended, and I've never even been a very religious person in a religious church, a bound church. But it offends me more than anything, even as a young man, that somebody would sit there and read a Bible verse as they were trying to become elected for something or make their point in a political venue, where they would use a faith-based, they would use words of Christ himself to...
But see, it works. That's why people do it. And that's what Revelation is speaking out against.
And that's why I'm in love with John. That's amazing, because that is what people are fighting over every day. And I agree that we shouldn't be going into our classrooms and expecting young men and women to learn about Christ in a state-based organization. Because that is for each individual in their church to learn through and become in their spirituality there. It's not something that we are supposed to do like a communist government and make sure that everybody understands who God is. If we wanted that, we would still be going through
and the church is and the school
executing people if they didn't believe in God. That's what
and
we would be doing.
And the school is there to teach the kids how to think and how to, heaven forbid, question the things that they're being taught.
Well, we're human. We're supposed to be able to question what we're doing.
Even when the school is run by the church, they must teach the children, the students, to question the beliefs they're being taught. Teach them how to think, how to say, is this true? Is this right?
Well, this is a sobering reminder to people, and I think this is probably why it's such a volatile subject, because most people don't want to give in to the mentality that somebody else should be telling them what they're doing. Most people want somebody to tell them what they're doing. They cannot understand the ideology that there's actually less control in having somebody telling you what you're doing. You have less ability to be a better person when you have somebody telling you how to be a better person.
But we mostly got through the introduction. Or the reminders of what.
Yeah. So that's kind of what we've discussed as major themes so far in Revelation. The last few chapters of Revelation, a brief review. Revelation 14 talked about three angels that announced judgment on Babylon. Revelation 15 was kind of an interlude where the plagues or the judgment was given to seven angels to in their bowls. Revelation 16, these seven angels pour out bowls of wrath. It's basically a description of false worship and its results. And this compared to the description of the true worship that is given by the first angel of Revelation 14. So false worship worships the beast, the dragon, Babylon. True worship worships the creator. In other words, false worship worships what is created. True worship worships the creator.
But then you would still take Revelation 16. Seven angels pour out the bowls of wrath. Punitive justice.
Well, but see, it's borrowing images and language from the Old Testament.
And in reality, it's not punitive. It is the consequence. And this is a...
It's what just happened.
Drama. It is not a...
Revelation 17, it was about the great prostitute and the beast. So this describes the source and the motivations of false worship. And it reveals the results of false worship, where basically the ten horns representing ten kings and the beast itself turned against Babylon. Mm-hmm. Where at one point these were all allied towards one object, that of destroying God's servants. In the end, they destroy themselves by turning on one another. And this is kind of parallel to the proclamation against Babylon that the second angel makes in Revelation 14. And so with that, we finally get to Revelation 18, where it begins with fallen is Babylon the Great. This echoes the second angel's proclamation in Revelation 14. It continues with the execution of judgment. And this would be kind of the third angel described the judgment and its results. John was told that he would be shown the judgment in the previous chapter, in Revelation 17, verse 1, but he was first shown a description of Babylon. And now in chapter 18, he is finally shown the judgment as it takes place. And in this first part, there is this phrase, "Come out of her, my people." Now, on first sight, it may be a little puzzling seeing a warning here, since so far Revelation has made a pretty clear distinction between the servants of God and those who are not. The servants of God already belong to God. Those who are not servants of God has been shown that they will never repent. So why is this warning here to come out of Babylon?
Implying that there are servants of God in Babylon.
This seems to fit best with the theme of the letters to the seven churches, where exhortations to faithfulness are given to God's people. The chronology in Revelation is not static, is not linear, it's more fluid. We don't know exactly how the chronology works. So prophecies cannot be assigned to a particular period in time in Earth's history. But we need to see that all of these messages should be seen more or less applicable throughout church history. And this current prophecy of "come out of her, my people" is most directly applicable to the church at John's time in its relation to Rome.
Just to refresh my memory, what was going on in Rome at this time? When we all talk about the fall of the Roman Empire, that was the fall of the empire, the civil country that conquered the world.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Many hundreds of years later.
Hundreds of years later. So this is when it was still in its formative.
This was still in the early part of the empire.
So not even yet in the height of the empire? Or the growing, the robust growing part of the empire, maybe? Oh, hi. Hello, welcome.
It's in what's called Pax Romana, Roman peace. Yeah. Rome had basically subdued all of its major enemies. So there were no major threats to Rome.
No, but what we're seeing is Rome was perfecting a civil...
The peace of Rome came through force.
Right. It was perfecting this punitive justice system, a form of government that John is repudiating, says it works.
It works. It works real well. Yeah. Rome, yeah. Look at Rome.
And Rome was perfecting that. And while Rome was perfecting that,
they had really good
John wrote this.
Yeah.
Okay. That was putting it in perspective.
Rather than like as Rome is waning and no longer going downhill or something.
It's going to...
It's on the uphill.
It's demise. It's building its own demise.
Correct.
And that's what he's saying is this system, even though it works, is going to fail.
The system based on imposition and violence and force will never survive. It may work for a time, but it will never survive.
He wrote that, and the people heard that.
That's what he was telling the Christians.
And they heard that before Rome. Rome was, like, growing. Okay.
And Rome was still growing. Rome was still growing throughout the lifetimes of the people who originally read this.
But unfortunately, by the time Constantine comes around in the year 300... the church falls into the very temptation that John is warning against.
Uh-huh. Of combining church and state.
The church, in order to gain respectability, to reduce oppression, to gain influence, to gain monetary support, joins forces. No longer opposes the empire.
Submits to worshiping the emperor and that sort of thing.
The relationships in
Europe. Yeah, although they did not literally worship the emperor, they figuratively worship the emperor by accepting its system.
And that system matured into what drove the Reformation.
So when the civil government to the church and says the church is the Christian church is what everybody will be now, and everybody's supposed to be Christians, then Christianity is accepting the government system and doing what it says here not to do.
Uh-huh. And ironically, those Christians used the book of Revelation and what was written in it to support their position. Uh-huh.
But Revelation was actually saying, do not try to combine.
But ironically enough, all churches nowadays run on an actual system based on what is outside the thinking that John is writing here because of their doctrine, and the entire system inside most churches now runs exactly how the outside world lined it out for them.
Well, if you're going to have a major organization, you kind of need...
No, you don't. That's what John's saying. John's saying, come out of
John, Jesus did not establish a religion. Paul did not establish a religion. John did not establish a religion.
But in order to organize a religion...
No, they didn't say that. They did not say, go out and make sure that you have all of these things lined out for everybody, hold everybody's hand, make sure they all hold hands exactly this way, and do it exactly how you feel it should be done.
I'm not saying that organized religion is necessary, but I'm saying it's easier to organize religion if you have all the rules in place.
Of course it is, man. You can put things together however you feel you need to make it work in your mind.
Up until the Council of Nicaea, every church had its elder or bishop, you know, in the Greek, bishop. They all had, their authority was limited to each of those local congregations or groups of congregations within a region.
And you didn't have...
But all of a sudden, once Rome gave its imprimatur on its, you know, its particular form, you know, it convened all these bishops.
In other words, Rome gave its approval to Christianity.
Now we can tell you what to do.
And so the government could now organize the religion.
About a year ago, there was an article in National Geographic magazine, which is not theology, but the cover of that magazine was a big picture of the apostles.
Uh-huh.
And that was its main title, article, whatever.
Uh-huh.
The author of that article, not sure where he got his information, said the amazing difference between the first century Christian church and all other churches since then is they did not have a hierarchy. Every church followed Christ.
Each church followed Christ, and each church didn't follow someone else who followed Christ.
Right.
They simply followed Christ.
As a consequence, there were very different beliefs by each region.
And when one person went to another region and discovered these different beliefs, they got upset about it.
Probably.
So two little kids are coloring the picture. It's okay if they use different colors for different parts of the picture.
But when the one kid looks at the other kid's picture, he's going to say, that's wrong.
No, not necessarily. If in their church they were teaching to accept, if they say that they believe in Christ, then that person is able to say okay. If they're walking in the way that they...
It's so hard to believe a certain way and still accept other people believing differently.
Yeah.
And practicing differently than you do.
And that's it.
I don't know. That's what my government's telling me I have to do all the time right now.
But that's in civil. That's okay.
You know, I mean, that's what I'm being told every day, that I have to accept everybody for who they are.
Mm-hmm. And approve everyone.
But you do.
But
that sometimes the civil, the government, is ahead of religious. Because we have to tolerate the different lives.
Because they're expecting it. They're mandating it.
So the other lifestyles, the different lifestyles that people choose, I may not appreciate, but I have no right to judge and to condemn them.
Because
I don't want somebody forcing me to believe that.
That's the thing right there, because the government will mandate that we accept these people when it may not be a good idea to do so. Because I'll tell you right now, a woman on a longshoring block trying to throw a 50-pound line 20 feet in the air does not make any sense. And when the government comes in and mandates that you have to hire women, and then there's two guys that have to do her job while she's still there getting paid for it, does not make any sense. It does not make any sense. So there is no logical aspect for something like that to happen. So no, they're not ahead of the church, because the church would have the responsibility and the fortitude to understand.
You said my comment.
All right.
Acceptance is appropriate. Mandating anything
is ridiculous.
So, coming
maybe
back to
John was common sense. Maybe he should have just, maybe the, you know, he had it right. It's just like pure common sense makes all the difference here, guys.
Yeah, so the system that Babylon represents is to be judged. In other words, it's going to destroy itself. Mm-hmm. And the warning to God's people to stay clear from its temptations, its enticements. Because in the short term, imposition and force and all these things work.
Isn't that what Jesus went to the wilderness and the devil came to tempt him and different
pretty much
governmental
yeah.
systems? The same subject.
The second part of Revelation 18 consists of three funeral dirges lamenting Babylon's fall. And the third part of Revelation 18, the first part of Revelation 19, is a description of heaven rejoicing over Babylon's fall and its utter destruction. Why is Babylon judged? That's the first part of Revelation 18, verses 1 through 8, which we are looking at. It's based on quite a number of Old Testament allusions against cities of that time, against Babylon, against Edom, against Tyre. So again, John is borrowing and reusing language from that time to describe Rome and what is happening.
Did literal Babylon still exist in John's time?
Not really.
Okay. So when he says Babylon, he's talking... Even the people of his day saw it figuratively.
The readers of this of Revelation would have no question as to what John was alluding
they
to.
They wouldn't say, you're talking about that city right there on the map.
No.
Okay.
Another angel with great authority comes, and this reveals the importance of what follows. Revelation 18 is kind of what the entire book of Revelation up to this point has been looking forward to. It's the answer to the cries of the saints. How long? How long will oppression and injustice continue to prosper? It fulfills the promise that judgment will happen without delay. That was announced in chapter 10. And so... fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Unclean spirits from the mouth of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. There's three that we saw in chapter 16. They were also spoken of as demonic spirits. And John is bringing that back in to this chapter in 18. The image of a destroyed city inhabited by unclean beasts is also found in the Old Testament in Isaiah and Jeremiah. So again, nothing new. No new imagery. So what are the reasons for Babylon's fall? This is found in verse 3. First, all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. Again, as a reminder, sexual immorality in Revelation is metaphorical. Cities cannot commit sexual immorality.
Is it saying that everybody's bought into this form of government?
Yeah.
Control.
They've been unfaithful to God?
Well no, it's, I don't do it
the,
God.
The first occurrence of sexual immorality is found in one of the seven letters in Revelation chapter 2, verses 20-22, in reference to where the letter brings in the image of Jezebel and her sexual immorality and her attempted seduction of God's servants. Again, the temptation for the church is what? Power, respectability, influence, security, stability. These things are intoxicating. Once you have them, you don't want to let it go. The world operates on these principles. Governments provide security and stability to its citizens.
Well, that's right where we are. So all nations
businesses provide security and stability to its employees.
And
they do?
Well, that's they do to an extent.
I'm a terrible boss because I never know if I'm going to make any money or not.
To the extent that they are able, they offer that.
Joking,
yeah.
I wanted to go back to the sexual immorality deal.
Yeah.
I believe that the reason why that is such a big deal is because in that time, that was the most horrific thing that a person could do to another person. That was what they believed to be the most just dastardly deed that you could impose upon your family or another person. And so that was why they used that imagery the most, is that that was like the most damning thing that you could do. And that reason why I say that is because after, like I said, watching the Nativity story five times this week, and then having listened to our sermon last week about what Joseph must have been thinking, and for him to have been able to find the faith to believe in Mary and God during that time, because at that time, in that place in the world, what must have possibly happened to Mary in his eyes was, that was worse than burning his house down or killing his entire family. It was the most imposition that she could impose on him, and he still took the ability to, or he still kept the ability to have that faith. So we read these, and I just believe that, you know, they used that as imagery because that's the most, you know,
no, part. Well, I think sexual immorality is different from, say, rape.
Right.
Rape is someone forcing something on you. Sexual immorality is your choice.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. Is it's
choosing
like
choosing adultery is.
And it may have something to do with the some of the pagan cults of that time, where some of the belief was that through sexual acts, you join in with and join in with the deities, and
in
you are able to receive their power and blessing.
Right.
Is it appeasing?
Not really appeasing, more of a way to gain their favor. The kings of the earth have committed immorality with her. That's the second reason. So all the nations, the kings, basically the entire world is what it is saying. And then the third, the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living. Merchants are a new character that is being introduced into Revelation here. We haven't seen merchants before.
Well, this, if you wanted to use one word to describe our economic civil system that is making the United States so powerful, it's Wall Street. And there's a lot of people that thought that, and that's why the Twin Towers were brought down, because that was a focus. And that is, you know, it was using wrong against wrong. But, yeah.
And if you combine the church with that power, then the corruption that ensues.
From someone's viewpoint, they
you
can, I could
call
see
that Babylon.
Mm-hmm. So, the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living. This word luxurious is strenos. It is the only occurrence in the entire Bible, this particular word. It can mean luxury, or it can mean sensuality. There's also a connotation of delicacy and strength. It's an allure, a strong allure of power. The New English Translation translates this phrase as, the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her sensual behavior. The indictment is not about wealth itself, but about the power it can buy.
The church wants power.
Just people.
The church gains power by participating in whatever it is that the immorality. In this culture, the church can gain power by participating in the emperor worship. But there's all sorts of things that the church can do to gain power. Trying to be active, politically trying to impose their will on government. That would be
Well, one person was talked to me a couple of weeks ago, months ago, about an issue that she had to deal with, a person in a government high position, and the person in the government said, it's legal, and that's the way we have to do it. And the other person responded, yes, it's legal on your books, but it's wrong. And that's what this is talking about.
Yeah.
Just because we've made legal laws doesn't make it right.
Right. Something may be legal, something may even be a right, but that doesn't make it ethical.
And we know Joseph came to this world.
Joseph?
Jesus was father.
Oh, you mean the genealogy with the
question?
Right.
So this is from the commentary reading Revelation. Taken together, the three elements that constitute the reasons for Babylon's fall reveal a wealthy trade center that garners the admiration, if not envy, of kings, merchants, and nations, all of whom align themselves with her in one way or another. Conspicuous by its absence in this description is any mention of the city's gods. In other words, Babylon is not condemned for her idolatry, but for its influence on the rest of the world. Could this be an indication that one of the most pressing concerns in the book, speaking of Revelation, is that of accommodation to the socio-economic enticements of the Roman Empire? See, idolatry in and of itself is never appealing. Whether it's an image or bundles of money, that in itself is not appealing. It's what those things represent. What they supposedly can get you.
Worshipping a certain god who promises security.
Yeah, worshipping Baal, a fertility god, or a fertility god who promises you rain so that your crops can grow.
Or children, which is lacking, and in your culture you must have children.
Right.
Or
the bundles of money where you can use to
power
by influence. Secure your future.
Well, I don't think John was writing about the United States. I think John was writing about Rome in his formative years and the power that it was imposing on its trades, on its neighboring countries, etc., etc. But the same warning would exist in our lives.
Yeah, correct. It definitely could apply.
We need to.
Even if he wasn't specifically thinking, it could apply to any number of world systems in different times.
Including my own. In conducting my life, am I doing what is legal? Am I doing what is correct? Or am I doing what is nice to my neighbor? You know, I need to look at the bigger.
Hence the warning, come out, is also applicable all through history, for every generation. So the call to come out of the doomed city, again, is a common Old Testament theme. And what are her sins? It's a reference to the previous verse.
So is he telling us to move to Canada or Australia or
something?
No, it's a metaphorical come out. It's not necessarily a physical move. It might be.
Then you go back to Portland.
the metaphorical aspect of that, what I see happen a lot, though, is people that take literally the ideology of needing to come away from society.
Mm-hmm.
Why does that always mean that they have to go back to the Dark Ages? No, I'm dead serious on that, because I know people in affluent situations that believe that they have to live like they're, you know, like they have nothing so that they can prove that they didn't gain anything by being good, hard-working people. And why is it that everybody takes that context right there and says, oh, now I need to live like I can't have anything cool, I can't do anything fun, I need to not influence people with what I've gained, I need to only work all the time, I'm only going to work, that's all I'm going to do. And so why does that happen? Why is it that people can't have anything fun and cool because they're trying to walk with God? What happened there? Why is it like that?
it condemns merchants and luxury, and it says, come out of her, my people. And if you take that literally, that means come out of the... Come out of the influence of merchants and luxury, and leave all of that, and...
So if you work hard, you can't buy a Ferrari? That is horrifying. No wonder nobody wants to do it.
I don't want a Ferrari.
Well, maybe I do. Exactly. Somebody might want four-wheel drive. Somebody might want this. See, that's where it starts to get really scary for everybody. Yeah. This is like, hey.
Yeah, this
if you
is
condemn the very act of
it's metaphorical.
Having luxury.
It's about recognizing what the temptations are and not succumbing to them.
I've seen people with Ferraris that are very offensive to me. I've seen people with Ferraris that's not offensive to me. Not the Ferrari. How did you get it?
The Ferrari can be offensive or not?
Well, I understand the how they got it thing. And that to me is what I think my point is if the way the person conducts themselves to their fruitfulness is more important than the fruitfulness itself. So if somebody is a hardworking, honest individual that is there to make sure that other people are capable of their same grace and fruitfulness, for lack of better words, then I think it's okay for a person to enjoy the luxuries of what they gain here in this world. I don't think that it's fair to say that, because, I mean, there's so many cool things. There's so much fun stuff to do. And to say that just because it's what is it that they use here?
Luxury.
No, the other one. It's enticing or sensual or that it, that it pulls you away from God by doing it. That scares me.
May I make a comment here? I think you bought a Ferrari.
I did.
Mark said power, security,
stability,
influence. It's power and influence.
Yeah.
That is the problem. It's not the Ferrari. It's this image that the non-tangible things that we...
So doesn't a person
that
even becomes... If your
focus is on having power over, say, other people...
Yeah.
It's just hard because even if you become affluent and you're not imposing power on somebody, people could still look to you because you did that.
That's the problem.
And you would... You know what I mean? I don't know, but I agree. That's probably right, because I'm still going to buy helicopters, man. There's no way.
Well, the truth comes out.
And I want my boat to have cool things on it, so I'm going to buy them.
Right, towards the beginning, we talked about the conflict is between truth. True worship, which is worship of the Creator, versus false worship, which is worship of the created.
Are you worshiping?
Yeah.
Sometimes. No, not really, but I understand the influences.
Don't you thank God for the resources you have and the people you meet because of it?
I do, but I'm kind of playing a little bit of the advocate here, because it all too often happens where faithful people that want to abide by these rules skew them in the ideology that they now have to divulge every enticement in the world in order to follow what is right, and that it ends up happening like you're supposed to just not have anything, you're never supposed to defend yourself, you're never supposed to have any ability to be better than what you think you are. And I think that that's a scary thing to fall into, because I think that we're allowed to be prosperous. I think that we're allowed to be the fullest human being we can be, as long as, like Jerry says, we're doing it by not trying to take over others, by not trying to make sure that other people know how great we are while we're doing it.
Well, let's ask a question. A rhetorical question. The the world system works. You do get security. You do get wealth. You do get power. You do get all that stuff. Now, your claim is that there's another system. There's restorative justice rather than punitive justice. There is a God's way. Is it possible to be wealthy with God's way?
Certainly.
Abraham was. Job was. Job probably is a better example because Job had it. He lost it.
But that didn't...
He didn't care about his wealth.
That's the point. And he got it back and he still is Job.
I have a question.
It didn't change who he was.
You've got, say, a banker making millions of dollars a year, and the lady who cleans his office making a few thousand a year. Is that banker really worth that many thousand times as much as the lady who cleans his office? Or is it simply because he has the power to set the wages that he can set it any way he wants for himself?
Power is an alluring thing.
Yeah.
The answer to that question is, I would dare say that Job probably was more wealthy than that banker.
Right.
In reality, you can. Let's assume that the banker was a godly, upright person. He probably was happy. And that cleaning woman was probably happy. And if they reverse positions, they probably won't be as happy, but you know, God will give you the talents and you can use them where you can in a godly fashion. And that was my question, based rhetorical question is, I think it is possible. Then Job's the answer.
Okay. I agree with that. That's where I was going, because all too often it worries me that in order to be faithful we have to
be cleaner women.
The problem,
yeah.
I think one of the problems with the banker is if he or she begins to value his worth based on whether or not he made the $10 million this year versus the 20.
When you make $10 million, yeah, it's easy to make that your definition of yourself, your value.
And if once you start comparing others based upon how much you make.
Well, one thing I've noticed is a lot of the wealthy entertain and use their monies in fashions that support a community where the poor really can't do that. And they just have more money, but they spend more money. So that's not necessarily bad.
It's not bad to be wealthy.
It's not bad to be wealthy. If that person uses the wealth, I think what happens is
hoarding the wealth is
exactly.
Many wealthy become attached to the wealth and want more. You know, it takes you back to the parable Jesus told about the rich man who, you know, had a bumper crop, decided to build a barn, and then God comes that same very night and says, this night,
it's over.
It's over, yeah.
Well, I have a hard time balancing. For instance, if a wealthy person, I've noticed there's some people in town, it seems like every year they spend a lot of money doing stuff for themselves, hiring local labor, local people to do stuff. And I have a problem with myself, how to balance buying local, supporting the local, encouraging the local, versus buying cheap somewhere else, which kind of depreciates the local economy. And I think that those with the means, doesn't matter where you are on the totem pole, you have to balance that somehow.
Where I have a problem is like back in 2008 when the banks failed, and the government, you and I, had to bail them out. And then those same banks paid bonuses to the very people that got them in financial trouble because they had a contractual obligation to pay these bonuses, which the people who got the bonuses voted for themselves.
But here's the answer to that, is that is the world's way, and John is telling us the world's way will fail. And even though those people got superficial money, they got millions in their pocket, are they happy? Would you rather be in their shoes? No.
So, as Christians, what John is saying is we see these injustices. The exhortation throughout the book is remain faithful, avoid the temptation to take on the world's ways. Remain faithful to God's ways. You may not see justice being done in your lifetime.
But like you were saying,
but it will happen.
The punitive justice versus the restorative justice, that everyone will get what they deserve, if you will.
No, they'll get what they sold.
They'll get what they chose.
Everyone will receive what they chose. The banker who took all the money and ran will not receive happiness from it.
And that's sad.
So it's pretty interesting that you will take your time and learn and love, but not cherish something so much that if it goes away, you can't live in love again. So it's like if you're doing something, like for instance, my operation, my fishing, that's something that I hold extremely dear to me, and it actually defines me and my faith even. But if I was to lose my fishing operation or lose the ability to do that, that would be undaunting in any way, shape, or form, because I would still have my faith.
You wouldn't lose yourself.
I wouldn't lose myself. I wouldn't be put in a position where I no longer felt like I deserved a place in this world because I couldn't anymore fish or fly helicopters. So I wouldn't be worshiping the creation. I would be worshiping the fact that I'm still created and have the ability to be in this world or be part of what God's given me. And that's a tough one because, man, that's what we're all about. We spend every day going, if this doesn't work, what am I going to do?
Trust, faith.
You know, it's for me, that's one that I struggle with a lot. I define myself a lot on whether or not I pull through on things or whether or not I can achieve them. And so even outside of a church, that's one that really just goes down into somebody's core. And there's very few people that I've met in my life that actually have that kind of status where you wonder where they get it from. Like, they just don't care about anything, but they seem to always have everything.
Yeah. So, her Babylon's sins are heaped high. God remembers her iniquities. Recall early in Revelation, God's mercy had prevented the full effects of judgment from falling.
That's right. It talked about a third were destroyed.
A third or a fourth. Yeah. It was limited in scope, but now, God remembers her iniquities. Those whose principles of justice are based on merit, in other words, deserving of earlier actions, rather than mercy, will receive what they sowed. Hosea 8, verse 7, talks about those who sow the wind will reap the whirlwind.
If your principles of judgment are based on merit, then you get what you deserve. If your principles of judgment are based on mercy, then you receive mercy.
If they're based on mercy and grace, you receive mercy and grace. If it's based on the basis of rewards and punishment, you'll receive what you deserve.
What you sow. And I think that's going to be amazing.
And what Jesus and the Gospels, the New Testament says is no one deserves rewards. Say, we all deserve punishment. So if our system of justice, if anyone's system of justice is based on merit, it will always be punishment in God's economy.
But it's not punishment, it's simply...
It is. It's getting what you sowed.
And I think we're going to be amazed how God pulled it off, because I sure don't know how he's going to do it.
Yeah, so God, you know, in my opinion, does not have to cause judgment. Judgment is going to be the natural consequence of principles followed to their logical end. So God remembering is then really that of removing the mercy that had been holding all of that back. So pay her back. We pay her double. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. But remember the wine that she used to tempt others. It's going to be used on her. The principles she promoted are going to be used against her. The idea of a double portion again is language from the Old Testament, Jeremiah 16, verse 18 in this case. So she glorified herself and lived in luxury. Says, I sit as a queen, and mourning I shall never see. The problem with Babylon is arrogance and boasting. She is secure in her ways. It's about security. Power can buy security. Or so she claims and she believes. But it is now going to be revealed that her foundations for security are empty. And when they are gone, she will lose her power, no security, and instead will find torment and mourning. This image comes from Isaiah 47, verses 7 through 9, which reads, you said, I shall be mistress, or queen, and as John interprets it, I shall be mistress forever, so that you did not lay these things to heart or remember their end. Now therefore, hear this, you lover of pleasures, who sit securely, who say in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. I shall not sit as a widow or know the loss of children. These two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day. The loss of children and widowhood shall come upon you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries and great power of your enchantments. So the reason Babylon falls, she places herself as the supreme being. She rejects natural orders and consequences. She believes that through her power, her sorceries, through her enchantments, she can prevent consequences from falling. So putting A and B together, trusting in one's own efforts to attempt to alter God's established ways and believing that is in fact possible. That is Babylon's problem. And so her plagues will come in a single day. The three dirges that follow immediately will use the phrase single hour. Again, time is metaphorical, it's fluid. It's not to be literally understood. One day, 1 hour, what it means is it's a very short period. So the meaning is quite clear. Destruction on Babylon will come swiftly once God's mercy is removed. She will be burned up with fire. Doomed cities in the Old Testament were said to be burned up with fire. And this also refers back to the ten horns and the beast who turns on the prostitute that was on the beast and burns her up. This is in chapter 17. And finally, mighty is the Lord God who has judged her. Babylon had claimed power. She believed herself to be the supreme power. But it is now seen that God is the one who actually holds power. And remember, John is writing to Christians who sees Rome, who is living in Rome. Rome claims to be the ultimate power in the world, in the universe. And this is assurance and reminder that there is one who is stronger than Rome. And God's judgment is allowing the principles that one trusts in to take their natural course and to reveal their end results. So as a summary of what we've talked about here, this is the beginning of what the saints have longed to see. The saints have been suffering under injustice. Finally, justice is being revealed. what is righteous versus what is evil is being revealed. That's essentially judgment. Judgment reveals what is right versus what is wrong. It's also a look into the future as a warning to the present. John is picturing what the final results of the wrong principles are going to be. And he is reminding his present audience to come out. In other words, don't fall into those temptations, those enticements. And the sin of Babylon is self-reliance. The results of self-reliance include arrogance, rejection of God and His ways, promotion of herself and her powers as something for others to worship.
See, if I would have just waited until Mark finished his sermon, I would have had my answers.
That was fun to discuss.